It is 24 minutes after the hour on a winsome Wednesday morning here along the Broken Road, a day that we typically have dedicated to biblical context over the years with many a conversation with Doug Greenwald of Preserving Bible Times. And today, well, Robbie Pruitt has joined us again. Robbie was with us a couple of weeks ago. Robbie is an Anglican pastor, works at a church in extreme northern Virginia. He's he's also a member of the board at Preserving Bible Times. Robbie, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Jim. Wonderful to be with you and David today. Thanks for having me on again.
You're welcome. Listen, I understand that from strong sources here that you are able to take apart a bicycle, put it back together blindfolded in 30 seconds using only a pair of tweezers and a nail file. Is that true?
Oh, man. Yeah, MacGyver was my favorite superhero growing up. And I used to watch that television show quite often. But yeah, my mom, there's rumors that I used to carry a screwdriver in my diaper called my Broke Fix It and my Ooh Iver. I would have a hammer and a screwdriver. But yes, okay. I like to repair bikes. That's my hobby on the side, as you may have heard from the Washington Post.
Yeah, I heard. I heard from unnamed sources that's the case, that you have repaired many a bicycle for kids that need them. You've done it from South Carolina to Haiti and now into Northern Virginia. In fact, you're so far north in Virginia, you're almost a Yankee. Is that true, too? I think it is.
Well, the good Lord brought me out west. Now I'm close to Leesburg, Virginia, living in Ashburn and serving at Church of the Holy Spirit, Leesburg. And, we're up to 175 bikes now, a little bit over. Mm-hmm. At this point, I'm starting to lose count.
Yeah, you fix them and leave them. You donate them. And that's a neat service. I wasn't sure that the kids rode bikes all that much anymore. Not like they used to. And when I was growing up, I remember it was a beautiful green Schwinn, and I have a suggestion for you. This could become your symbol. I always put a playing card in the back of mine, fastened into so it would go in the spokes. You know, sound like a motorcycle. I use a clothespin, and you should leave the King of Hearts on each of your bikes here. I think to symbolize the spirit of your ministry. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Huh.
And give it away that way. Well, you've already got a reputation. It's a good one. I wouldn't want to sully it with a playing card. But you use best judgment on that one. Robbie, you're a fan of archaeology, and through the years, we've with Doug rarely touched on archaeology because he was interested in it, but was not a student of it particularly. But I remember his story about how modern archaeology really got its start in the middle of the 19th century, 1860s about, when science started getting involved in archaeology and paleontology, and it began to undergo some discipline. And there was, I believe it was a French historian, I'm sorry I don't have his name, but he was a student of the Bible and had identified 100 biblical locations that he said, if these are verified via archaeology, it will absolutely prove the historicity of the Bible. That was accomplished in the 1990s. All 100 have been verified and identified and found. Our interest in archaeology here is important because it relates to context. Context we usually think of as being what's between the lines and the white spaces of Scripture, but history is already written there, and the ability to verify it is an important element in context. You're a contextual student and an archaeology student as well. What brought you to archaeology? What started the fire there?
Well, Doug also really liked quotes, and Randy Smith said the gospel writers assume their readers lived when, where, and how they do. They have no need to explain what everyone knows. They just thought you knew because you lived there like they did. So the archaeological record actually exposes the actual context of the first century, and we can see what people saw and see artifacts from that time. And we've found biblical places like the Pool of Siloam in 2004 was dug up and found that it was a mikveh. Things of that nature, the Pool of Bethesda in the north, and it's also a mikvah, and you can go to these places where Jesus healed the blind man in John chapter 9 at Siloam, and the man laying lame by Bethesda in John chapter 5. So these places actually exist, things like the Burn Layer in Hatzor and the Galilee region, where archaeologists discovered that tell and was uncertain what they were even looking at. And the biblical record with the Burn Layer in the time of Joshua and the conquest, the conquering and the settling of the land. Yeah, archaeology is just fascinating. And you can really just go back in time and go to the places and see the things that the biblical authors saw and the people of biblical times lived in. And you can go and live in that environment and see it for yourself.
Now, of course, the beginnings of archaeology, I mean, it goes back centuries. People have always had an interest in antiquities. Mm-hmm. Early on, it was an interest in relics. People would lay claim to even body parts of the apostles or of other saints and display them in their churches and their cathedrals and would make their reputation that way. And, of course, there became, because they were so valuable and so highly prized, a black market. There were scholars combing the Middle East for relics and antiquities, old things, and largely stole them. They were pilfered, yes. Brought back to places like the British Museum or museums in Germany, under the assumption that the societies, the native people in the Middle East would see them destroyed, particularly during the early Islamic years, when so much of Christian history was torn down. So archaeology really arose out of that and has become ethical. Correct?
Right.
And it's part science, part art, isn't it?
It is, and unfortunately, that issue of archaeology, the black market, relics, and the demand for biblical artifacts has even carried over into the opening of the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C., where some of the fragments that have been discovered at the Dead Sea Scrolls have been proven to be not real, and there was a whole controversy around that concerning the Museum of the Bible in D.C. So the Green family and the Passages exhibit that traveled around with some of these artifacts, some of which have been verified false. So, yes, there is a black market for artifacts, which encourages people to not ethically dig and to steal and to forge artifacts. So it really is a complex situation when the market demands things of that nature. You have to be careful looking through some of these artifacts that are being sold.
But that I'm sorry, Dave, go ahead.
At your experience at the Museum of the Bible, have you ever experienced where you had to give some things back? Or you had to move things from the Bible or from the exhibit back to an original place?
Yeah, I would point people to the Museum of the Bible's website, motb.org, and encourage them to read. The Museum of the Bible has done an excellent job surrounding themselves with scholars and really performing very ethically in terms of returning and paying restitution and things of that nature. And all of that's been documented. And even now, as a little bit of background, I'm a docent and volunteer at Museum of the Bible. For 3 years, I was a living history interpreter and a recreation of a first century village of Nazareth. So I got to be there with the opening of the Museum of the Bible and be a part of one of the first inaugural docent class. But the Museum of the Bible has really done a wonderful job of scholarship and ethical handling of all the artifacts there. If it's in question, it's noted on the display case, and some artifacts, many of which, thousands of them, never made it, you know, on display, that it's in storage.
Hmm. You know, unlike other antiquities, though, the things of the Middle East, the things of the Bible and biblical history, and the ignoble beginnings, the contention, the black market, the illegal doings, all the loathsome behavior that's happened there is testimony. In fact, becomes part of the story itself, because if it were not for the spiritual value, those things would not have the financial value that they have. So they combine to tell a great story.
Correct. It's supply and demand, because people want to see this history. And so the demand is there. So the supply is limited. So sometimes these things are forged, or other times they're stolen if they're real artifacts. Or you get things like ISIS destroying, you know, the Nineveh, the capital of Assyria. Some of the artifacts that are there have been pillaged and destroyed and sold on the black market to fund various activities that are less than stellar.
Mm. You've talked about a couple of recent discoveries too, and you mentioned mikveh. Mikveh is a ritual bath. It's kind of like a little stone cellar, usually, and I think exclusively wherever there's moving water. Correct. The water would have to be moving through a mikveh to do the ritual cleansing, right?
Right. So it's purification. The water has to come in naturally. It cannot be carried by hand. It has to flow in and flow out. So it has to be, quote, living water. So a mikveh is a stone pool, and it's sealed with mortar that is created like thin mud that's plastered over. It's like a plaster, and it holds water, and the water flows in from rainwater. It can be a spring, it can be a river, where the water flows in naturally and flows away. The Jews would immerse themselves completely, and that living water would carry away their impurities. On the southern steps of the Temple Mount, there are many mikvod, plural, and these baths were used for purification, and there would be inspectors. You would have to be completely disrobed. It was all men in this area that would immerse themselves completely disrobed. They could not touch the floor, the sides of the mikveh. They must go totally under. Their hands would be on top of their head, and there would be inspectors to see if the hairs on the hand were wet, that indeed they would be fully immersed, and that the living waters would carry away those impurities. So we see this with the Essenes on the northwestern shore of the Dead Sea,
Qumran,
where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. The Essenes had many mikveh that were there for purification, because it has to do with before they would write the scrolls of the old, what we know as the Old Testament, the Torah, the law, the prophets. They would immerse themselves in the mikveh, and so there was a scriptorium in Qumran. And the Essenes would write and scribe the Torah scrolls, and they would immerse themselves in the mikveh for purification before they would do it. So also before offering sacrifice at the Temple Mount, you would immerse yourself in the mikveh, and hundreds of thousands of pilgrims would come to the Temple Mount around Passover. And the mikvod on the southern steps would not be enough capacity for them. So Herod the Great, around 40 BC, when he rebuilt the Temple Mount to appease the Jews, he built two massive pools. One is in the south at the end of Hezekiah's tunnel, which you can walk through. I've actually walked through it.
And that was built to bring water in during a siege, was it not?
That's correct.
Just
in the days of the kings, Hezekiah, when the north was seized by Assyria in 722 BC, King Hezekiah was fearing a siege on the south and brought the water into the city through. And this was the same water tunnel that David sieged the city. He came up through the water tunnel, and it's this water tunnel that Hezekiah dug from this spring. They had two parties meeting in the middle, and they even left an inscription where they met inside the tunnel, and that inscription is in a museum today. The pick marks from the two parties are actually in different directions, and they meet in the middle.
That would have been quite an engineering feat in itself in its time, wouldn't it?
It was. And at the end of this water tunnel is, and it's the Gihun Springs is the water tunnel that was, that David had sieged the city. But they, Hezekiah brought in the Gihun Springs into the city walls through his tunnel, 700, you're talking 700 BC. So this tunnel is almost 3,000 years old. Mm. It's 1,000 cubits long. And at the end of that tunnel, King Herod, 40 BC, builds the Pool of Siloam. It was a small pool when it was initially found, and people had thought that it was just a small pool. But in 2004, it was hit by a backhoe and some road work, and they called in the Israeli Antiquities Authority and found steps. Only one side of the steps have been unearthed. The rest of the pool is under private land, but it's about the size of a football field. Enough to...
My goodness.
Yeah, it's enough to have hundreds of thousands of pilgrims come purify themselves at Passover. So initially, people could not believe that hundreds of thousands of pilgrims would come into the city to offer sacrifice because there weren't enough mikveh. It was even questioned that the Pool of Siloam was a mikveh until they found the steps and realized it was a mikveh. But then the scholar said, well, by the time that people get up to the southern steps, they're going to be impure walking the road. So someone said, well, if we found the mikveh and we believe the Pool of Siloam is a mikveh, there must be a road. So they uncovered a step street from the Pool of Siloam up to Robinson's Arch. Mm-hmm. Robinson's the name of the archaeologist that discovered the arch on the southwestern corner of the Temple Mount. And that road from Siloam up to Robinson's Arch is a dedicated pilgrim's way for those who were offering sacrifice up on the Temple Mount. Mm.
Is that same Hezekiah tunnel, the water system for the temple itself? Because they needed a lot of water, especially during the slaughter of the Paschal lambs. I mean, they needed a water system running through the temple. Is that the source?
Well, it's one of them. Doug pointed out that, you know, the Kidron Valley, many scholars have pointed out that the Kidron Valley would run blood red during Passover. But you orient yourself, if you've got a pool in the south and the water's flowing south, in the north there's another pool. There's the Pool of Bethesda. It's the pool with five porches. That was actually debated for quite some time as well. Did it exist? Many people discredited the Gospel of John because it mentioned these two pools. And they wondered, well, there's no such structure with five porticos, five porches. You see this in John chapter 5. Well, Hezekiah also built a dam in a ravine to create a pool as part of the water source to enable Jerusalem, the holy city, to be able to last through a siege if the Assyrians would come. Now, we know that Babylon destroyed the Temple Mount in 586 BC. They destroyed the temple, took the people captive into Babylon, took the Israelites into captivity. But in the north, when Hezekiah is also building this water structure, he builds a dam, and there's a spring there, and he creates a pool, and a road would go across that dam. Again, in 40 BC, when Herod constructs the Temple Mount, begins his construction, he also builds another dam further south from the one that Hezekiah had built, creating not one but two pools, and he built five porticos. Picture like a figure eight. And so you've got, four porticos and then one slicing the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got two pools. The southern pool, the southernmost pool, has stairs into it, again, as a mikveh. Mm-hmm. If it is a spring, it is living water, and that water would come into the northern pool. The dam had valves, and again, this has been dug up. You can read this about this in the Biblical Archaeology Society. Has plenty of articles if you go to biblicalarchaeology.org. and just do a quick search on the Pool of Siloam, you will see some of the research there. But yes, they found that that this northern pool was feeding the southern pool, and then that water would flow out down towards the Temple Mount as one of the water sources.
That's impressive. And when you consider that they slaughtered as many as 200,000 lambs during Passover, you can see why that water was invaluable, essential. I mean, imagine the mess it would be without that, without running water. Now, you recently, you told me about a recent discovery at the Mount of Olives as well, another mikvah. What does the presence of a mikvah indicate in terms of the use of the area?
Jim, when that was discovered and released, a short article on the biblicalarchaeology.org site, I was so excited, because where they excavated this particular mikvah was to the south of the church built on the Mount of Olives in the Garden of Gethsemane. We believe that the Mount of Olives, well, it's still an olive grove, and this is where Jesus went to pray before Judas betrayed him into the hands of religious leaders, again at Passover. And we believe that Jesus goes to the Mount of Olives. This is one of his favorite places to pray, and I believe that he knows someone there, either someone who owns a plot of land that has on the Mount of Olives, or someone who owns the olive mill where the olives are processed. So this church was built on the Mount of Olives, where they believe Jesus prayed on that night he was betrayed. If you look at John chapter 7 towards the end, right before the beginning of 8, where the woman is caught in adultery, it says that Jesus arose early in the morning from the Mount of Olives, and he goes to the temple.
Mm-hmm.
Which means, in John chapter 7, we see Jesus camping out on the Mount of Olives.
And I suspect that was a regular place for him to do exactly that. He had no house of his own. He had friends that would put him up.
Birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. So he is beholden to the hospitality of his friends and strangers. But this is no stranger, because we see him staying somewhere on the Mount of Olives. And again, we see him going there at Passover to pray with his disciples, all of them minus Judas, who is betraying him into the hands of the religious leaders. He goes there with his 11 disciples to pray. He takes away Peter, James, and John and goes to a solitary place. Now, if this is the case, they are somewhere specific, not just a grove of olive trees, which is what the Mount of Olives is. He's not just under some random tree. I believe he is in the place of Gethsemane. Gethsemane means place of pressing.
Mm-hmm.
There is no Garden of Gethsemane. It's a mountain of olive trees. There is no garden. We call it the Garden of Gethsemane out of tradition. But it is a place, Gethsemane means place of pressing. It's an olive mill which crushes the olives. Then there's an olive press, a Gethsemane, that presses the crushed olives to bring out the olive oil. The olives are crushed three times. The first pressing is first fruits unto the Lord. It's for worship. You dedicate it to the temple like you do with first fruits. Well, what does the temple need with olive oil? Well, you light the menorah, you light the candles. It's for anointing of prophets, priests, and kings. It's for the healing and sustaining of the nations. You anoint with oil kings, and you anoint for healing. Think about the Good Samaritan, where it says that the Good Samaritan poured oil and wine in the man's wounds. The next pressing is good for food. It's good for the table. You eat it. The third pressing is dark in color. It's almost blood red, and it's not good. It's bitter to eat, but you can burn it in your lamps. So Jesus is in the Gethsemane after the olive harvest. People can sleep there. At Passover, the city is way too crowded and cannot house the hundreds of thousands of pilgrims that are coming there. Jesus knowing someone, and we can tell this right from John chapter 7 at the end, where he comes out of Gethsemane. Clearly, he's sleeping there often. He probably knows someone that owns a plot of land or even owns the Gethsemane.
An influential friend, huh? Someone with close connections to the temple, no doubt. In a business relationship. Yeah. Interesting. Well, that's the kind of thing that archaeology teaches us. And we're glad that it's being done and that there's respect being shown for the antiquities of old and the places of old. And Robbie, you brought together three or four different elements of context right there. Historical, linguistic, with the meaning of Gethsemane, cultural. It's all part of the space between the lines, and we learn a lot from that. Thank you, Robbie. Appreciate having you here, and we'll look forward to future conversations as we delve into this even deeper. Okay?
Can I put one more question in?
Oh, if you make it quick.
Is it possible it's Nicodemus?
Ooh, that's a thought.
Who knows?
Robbie?
I do not know.
Okay. All right. Because Nicodemus is mentioned later in the chapter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. There's a thought.
Yeah, he's mentioned in verse 50.
We'll explore some of that. Again, we're talking with Pastor Robbie Pruitt from Virginia, who is a whiz with bicycles and archaeology, it turns out, not to mention the context of the Bible. We'll look forward to our next conversation, Robbie. Have a great week.
Good to you, Jim. Thanks.
We'll see you.
Bye-bye. For having me.